Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And I'm Richard Dean Winfield.
The American economy is fundamentally a struggle between the employee and employer. It determines the relations of who works and how we work. Just ask most workers in this country, and I guarantee you they'd have some sort of gripe about their boss. And this is why labor is so crucial and a crucial topic for us. And in the American context, it is simply one of those sectors that is largely ignored and left behind. Rights, as they are so known in America, don't include the issues felt by laborers. And on top of that, collective bargaining is actively stifled at the source, all in name of ruining a search for change in workplace. The history is also there to show these hardships of these workers, and we'll get into that history. But to set up, Richard, could you elaborate on the core strife between the employee and employer?
In general, in markets, you have a social situation where individuals face one another as owners of commodities, and they're relating to one another in a manner where, to participate in market relations, they have to have a need for what others own, but in order to obtain what others own, they have to have ownership on their part of something that their counterpart desires and has need of. Because we're not dealing with unilateral appropriations. We're dealing with relationships of voluntary exchange. And there's an element of reciprocity in every engagement in market relations. And it's for that reason that when you look at the thinkers who try to comprehend markets and a society where production and consumption operate through markets, you know, we find that they take often as their starting point a situation of individuals who come to the market with different kinds of goods, which they themselves have come up with. That is, they're sort of individual producers. And there's a kind of division of labor between them. That is, they're producing things that others are not producing. They have a surplus. They have numbers of such goods that they themselves are not going to consume. And others are producing the objects that they need in return. And that then presents us with this notion of markets where, in effect, everyone operates as a small little entrepreneur. And insofar as one operates in terms of complementary types of productive activities, it's possible for this whole association to continue in existence and to reproduce itself. But it turns out that markets cannot remain societies of individual producers. Competition imposes a necessity that an entrepreneur has to grow and expand in order to remain competitive, in order to develop new products, in order to achieve various kinds of efficiencies in production and marketing, which allow them to beat the competition. So markets inevitably involve, on the one hand, a growth and concentration of individual enterprises that become ever larger, obtaining ever-increasing revenues, allowing them to make ever larger investments in their productive and marketing infrastructure. And on the other hand, a growing number of individuals who must seek employment from these enterprises in order to satisfy their own needs. In other words, we have a polarization in markets between, on the one hand, enterprises and employers, and on the other hand, employees. And this polarization involves a great discrepancy in the numbers of these two participants. Because on the one hand, because enterprises have to grow and consolidate in order to remain competitive, there are always a much smaller number of enterprises than there are employees. And they have need of growing numbers of employees to maintain their larger productive and marketing businesses. So even though everyone enters the market in a situation of reciprocity where you have something to offer that some other market agent has and that they can only obtain from you what you have to offer in return for offering them what they have, the options of the parties to the market are not by any means equal. because enterprises are going to have greater and greater amounts of wealth on their side and are going to be facing ever larger numbers of employees, they have much more options in terms of finding employees. Employees, on the other hand, have far fewer options for employment in return. And this sets up very much a discrepancy in opportunity and an imbalance. And that, of course, has led to a situation where employees have sought to somehow nullify this discrepancy by joining together. And just as enterprises have basically consolidated themselves, so the workforce consolidates itself into a group that will bargain as a whole, as one, with greater strength with the employers they face. Now, what testifies to the dominance of the polarity of employee and employer are just the numbers you find in the United States and you find in any other modern civil society, in which slavery has been abolished, in which everyone is the owner of his or her own labor power, and in which the dynamic of competition has been able to sort of run its course. You find that in the United States, 85% of breadwinners are employees. But that really underestimates the total. Because in the United States, according to the government's own figures, there are almost 25 million so-called small businesses. And they're characterized as small businesses by having 500 or fewer employees. But it turns out 82% of these small businesses have no employees. That means that of these 25 million small businesses, more than 20 million actually are what could be considered piece workers. That is, they have a good or service to offer, and they're having a tough time because in selling things on a piecework basis, they have no guaranteed hours, they have no guaranteed benefits. And most of these people who think of themselves as entrepreneurs but are really what could be called piece workers, and often now members of the new gig economy, they're barely scraping by. Now, the other side of this polarity, where we find the overwhelming number of breadwinners being employees of one sort or another, is that the enterprises are becoming more and more dominated by a particular form of ownership. Because in principle, enterprises can be owned in various ways. They could be owned by a single individual. They could be owned by a family. They could be owned by a municipality or a province or a state. They also could be a worker cooperative. But it turns out that the dominant form of ownership of enterprises in a market are share-issuing public corporations. That is, corporations that offer stock, allow people in the market to buy shares in the corporation. And the reason this becomes a dominant form is that this allows an enterprise to acquire capital on as great a scale as possible to allow it to make the kind of productive investments that allow it to remain competitive. And in this way, companies can issue shares. They don't have to pay for any charges for borrowing money, and they can have shareholders be from anywhere in the world. And I think this sort of reflects the situation of an alternate form that, you know, some people think has an affirmative value, that is worker cooperatives, where workers own the enterprise in common. In the United States, there are only 300 worker cooperatives. Athens has a few of them. One you may know of is called Peachy Clean, which cleans houses, and it's a workers' cooperative. But there are only 300 of these worker cooperatives in the U.S., and they only employ 7,000 workers. And if you ask yourself why, it's simply that they do not have access to enough capital to be competitive. Right? If they're owned by the workers, then their capital consists of what the workers themselves provide. And that's very, very limited. Now, if we really want to understand the situation of social justice in this country, we have to look at how the employee-employer relationship functions here. And a key part of this is to understand two things. One is, what is the situation of labor unions in the United States? And in connection with this, we have to look at what are the laws that are governing the worker-employer relationship, because they have a tremendous impact on where things stand.
So given the current market incentives, the way that you've laid it out and described it, simply put, it sounds like the biggest fish will eat the smaller fish, and the smaller fish will not be able to sustain their own unless they per se join forces with the bigger fish. It's maybe a weaker analogy, but the point being that through competition, those smaller businesses that are so touted are typically either taken up by other businesses, bigger businesses, or they're simply just small units that don't actually provide any sort of employees to the people. So like you were saying, it seems the real battleground then for us employee rights and those people who are living paycheck to paycheck is going to be these bigger corporations. You're hinting at the possibilities for unionization in these corporations. And unionization, to me, has core tenets that make a lot of sense. If you ask somebody how the inner workings of a business are, you might not actually, or what they're like, you might not actually find out the true nature of that from the top. They are dealing with a larger scope of what the actual business is like. But the workers, of course, will know the day-to-day operations of that business, and they'll have hands-on technical knowledge sometimes. And it seems like their opinion is extremely valid and very valuable in certain situations. So to me, that seems like a strong argument for unionization. Have a voice of the people who are working and dealing with the product and every day, so that there could then be a better product. But also the benefit of unions is simply securing rights for the people in the unions, that they don't have to be as insecure about what their job status might be, especially given the fear that oftentimes is ensued by oppressive managerial personnel. So could you give us a more fleshed out reason why the unionization is maybe beneficial, not just for those on top who might actually learn something from their workers, but also better for the workers as well?
I think you've raised some important points about how, when we're talking about the polarity of employer and employee, you know, we're talking about a relationship involving two types of economic functioning that can be occupied by different people and different groups of people. But in a way, they all have interests that could be regarded as legitimate interests. You know, a legitimate interest in a civil society is one where its satisfaction is something that enables other parties to be able to satisfy interests of their own. Now, that's really true of any kind of commodity relationship. You know, you engage always in exchanges where you're obtaining something that satisfies a need that you've chosen to pursue. And you can only do that on the condition of allowing your partner exchange to do the same. In other words, any kind of enterprise operates insofar as interests of consumers, of its employees, and of course of the employer are in some respect being satisfied. And in a way, we don't want to presume that any interest has any privileged character. I mean, Marx at one point in his career regarded the proletariat as having a universal interest. And the universal interest of the proletariat, which differed from all other social interests in being universal and not particular, was due to the fact that Marx alleged in his youth that workers owned nothing. They were devoid of property. Therefore, they had no stake in society. And therefore, their interest was something that involved the negation of society, overturning of society, and transforming the current situation into an entirely new new social order. They were a revolutionary subject. But Marx later recognized, and he did this in his major work, Capital, that every individual in civil society actually does have one property, and that is they are the exclusive owner of their own body, because slavery has been abolished, And that means they own also the restricted use of their body for a limited period of time. That is their labor power. And that, of course, becomes the ultimate anchor of one's economic independence, as that to which one can always fall back to try to earn a living. But that means we employees have a particular interest. And it's not a matter of making that interest reign supreme. It's rather giving that interest what could be called equal due, of shall we say, balancing the playing field between employer and employee and overcoming this huge discrepancy in opportunity that the concentration and consolidation of enterprises involves as an inevitable result of competition. Now, it turns out that the dynamic of competition is producing more and more powerful enterprises, putting employees in a, you might say, a weaker position. This has been compounded by two developments that are racing ahead. I should say three developments. One is globalization, which gives enterprises the ability to transfer their operations all over the world, and in doing so, to take advantage of all sorts of low-wage populations, and in that way, combat the efforts of people in the United States, for example, to maintain their wage levels and maintain levels of employment. Then, of course, there's the rise of the gig economy, where now, thanks to the ubiquity of cell phones and cybernetics and the internet, it's possible for enterprises to find people to employ anywhere at any time for any amount of time, and to avoid having to pay for the overhead of having, you know, fixed office buildings and factories and so forth. They can farm everything out wherever they want. And this now is something that is, in a way, undermining the full-time job, because more and more people throughout the world are finding themselves becoming so-called contingent workers, so-called zero-hour workers, so-called gig employees, who have no guaranteed hours, no benefits, and they have no opportunity to engage in actions of solidarity with their fellow gig employees because they're completely dispersed from one another. Now, in the United States today, the percentage of wages in our national income is the smallest they have ever been. And the fall of wages as a percentage of our national income began taking place and accelerating in the late 60s. And it has been accompanied, as one would expect, by an increasing income inequality and wealth inequality in the United States, where we are now approaching the levels of the Gilded Age, the most unequal period in our history. And that is happening because whereas our productivity has more than doubled, wages have stagnated, that means a smaller and smaller share of our national income is going to employees, and a much larger share are going to those who own enterprises. And this has accompanied a fall in union membership, not surprisingly. You know, the union membership in the United States as a percentage of employment peaked in 1954. The high water mark was 35% of employees were unionized in 1954. By 1983, that had dropped to 20%. Today, the percentage of employees in the U.S. who are unionized is 10.3%. That's only 14.6 million employees out of more than 160 million employees or so. Well, I shouldn't say that. Of breadwinners, about 160 million breadwinners, at least about 145 million employees, and only 10.3% are unionized. Now, by the way, this figure is also to some degree misleading for the following reason. Currently, there are only 6.2% of private sector employees who are unionized. That's 7.5 million. Only 16.2%, which means in the private sector, you know, about 94% of employees have no union to stand up for their rights. Now, the public sector, and I'm giving 2019 figures, the public sector, the rate of unionization is 33.6%. That involves 7.1 million employees. Now, that is obviously a much bigger number, but you have to take it with a grain of salt. And the reason you have to take it for a grain of salt is because if you are a public sector worker who belongs to a union, in most states in this country, the union you belong to has its options severely curtailed by what are identified in very Orwellian language as right-to-work laws. You know, I'm a public sector employee. I've been working since 1982 at the University of Georgia. And I am subject to right-to-work laws, which are similar to those in many, many other states, pretty much in every state that has been dominated by a Republican legislature and governor. And what do those right-to-work laws do in a state like Georgia? It means that even though I supposedly can have a union, the union of a public sector employee cannot engage in collective bargaining. And a public sector worker cannot go on strike. This is something that was made a federal law, by the way, in the Taft-Hartley law that prohibited government employees from going on strike. So you could say that this 33.6% of public sector employees who are unionized really belong to a very neutered union organization. So really, when one looks at the situation in the United States, labor is in a very, very weak position if one regards unions as being something that enhances employee empowerment. Because if you look at other nations, virtually all developed nations have higher rates of unionization. Iceland comes at the top with 90.4%. of employees unionized. Sweden has 66.1%. Belgium has 54.2%. The UK has 23.2%. Canada has 25.9%. Japan has 17.1%. Germany has 16.7%. Mexico beats us with 12%. We are at the bottom with 10.3%. And by the way, if you look at how things stand inside the United States, I think we all know that if you're living in the South, as I am, the rate of unionization is much less than in other parts of the country. Now, that testifies to a real fundamental disempowerment of labor in the United States. It testifies to a great imbalance in how the interests of employers and the interests of employees are being treated. And what in a way reflects this imbalance and has played a major role in both sustaining it and in certain ways intensifying it is U.S. labor law.
So one of the taglines I think that for me is sort of funny about the left is liking weekends. Aren't they great? But there's some serious truth to that. And along those lines, there's just a plethora of laws about child labor laws, and also in addition to that, just having protections that you expect today that you wouldn't have in the past. Now, those go back really far, to the Industrial Revolution, even before, and you'll probably be able to give us more of a history of these labor laws, but something that's pertinent to me and probably to a lot of people today is this question of the gig economy. It's a simple question, but I'm not entirely sure if it's new or not in the way that people talk about it. But my confusion around it is to in what ways will this new system of gig economy infiltrate the political system to repurpose some of these problematic pasts that we have. So maybe at least talking about it, and it's also important to note that a lot of this has been exacerbated by COVID-19. People even talk about today whether certain companies will go back to work at all. Logistics firms, I've heard, will even have their employees working from home almost entirely. So this is something that's a radical shift. I mean, the physicality of being at work has been a historical constant. But in what ways will the competition of the market drive employers to abuse this new system so that their employees aren't able to actualize their rights? And also, I think maybe looking at the history will help us reflect on some of the past successes or failures and in reference to today's problems.
I mean, I think the rise of the gig economy clearly involves a further disempowerment of labor, because without exception, all of the new gig enterprises are non-union, and they are able to maintain themselves as non-union because their dispersed gig employees are all operating in complete isolation from one another. Now, you can compare the situation of employment in the United States today with what it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the largest U.S. companies, the largest companies with the largest numbers of employees, were all unionized firms. We're talking about Ma Bell, AT&T. We're talking about General Motors. We're talking about Ford. And, you know, their employees had, well, let's put it this way. They had salaries that were certainly far above the minimum wage. They were sufficient so that one breadwinner could actually support a family. And their wages, by and large, increased as the productivity of a nation increased, so that as we became a more productive, more wealthy nation, the wages kept pace with that increase. Today, the biggest employers are all non-union. We're talking about Walmart. We're talking about McDonald's. We're talking about Yum Brands. And with the pandemic, you know, we're talking about Amazon. And they are all non-union. All of the new high-tech companies are all non-union. In other words, we have developments in our economy that are empowering employers and disempowering employees at a rate that is really gaining ground and is, I think, in a way that is fairly obvious, is on the one hand contributing to the increase in wealth and income inequality in this nation, which of course also plays a role in sustaining and intensifying racial and gender disadvantage. But also this is something that's a threat to democracy. Because when we have the degree of inequality in economic power that you see in the situation of employers on the one hand and employees on the other, this inevitably undermines the equal political opportunity of citizens.
And the bargaining power of somebody who's sitting at home from their computer, we've seen through maybe online activism, I guess, is just not going to be there the way that physical presence is going to be there.
Now, there's one thing that has sort of been operating in the background from actually the earliest days of settlement in the United States or in the New World. And that is that there is this idea that we think of right as primarily consisting in respect for property, and that the role of government is to do nothing other than to uphold the person and property of individuals. And that was sort of the idea motivating the social contract theoreticians like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, who inspired the founders of our Constitution. You find those ideas taken up by the avatars of neoliberalism and the minimal state, who want to say that there really are no other rights. And that means when you apply this notion that property rights are the emblem of freedom to the situation of the market, that means that, you know, you recognize that as long as we engage in a voluntary agreement, the terms of that agreement are to be considered authoritative. And on that grounds, there's been a history of any kind of resistance to any rules that want to restrict what agreements might be reached in the marketplace. And you mentioned some of those, right? There have been laws that have attempted to restrict child labor. Well, child labor involves the employment of children. They're not simply taken as slaves. They, in some respect, enter an agreement with the employer. Women entered an agreement with employers to be paid lower wages. People entered agreements to work 14-hour workdays, 6 or 7 days a week. They agreed to enter work situations that were deadly and unhealthy. They agreed to enter into all sorts of situations. Why? Well, it had something to do with what other options they had. Because everyone in a civil society is under the compulsion of having to earn a living. And if you do not have sufficient options to earn a living, you are compelled to enter agreements that reflect that lack of opportunity. Now, we see this opposition between those who want to say that, well, property relations are the only thing that count. Contracts of any sort are to be regarded as valid. And those who want to fight for the social rights of individuals so that they should all have a decent living, so that there should be constraints regarding hours of work, conditions of work, how low payment can be, etc. Now, you see this in the history. You know, in colonial times before 1775, the common law that was operative treated any kind of associations of employees, any unions, as illegal conspiracies. As illegal conspiracies, why? Because they were conspiring to, in effect, restrict the freedom of contract. They were trying to limit, in a sense, what employers could do vis-a-vis employees. Now, it's interesting that the common law at that time would be regarding unions as criminal conspiracies, because at that same time, the common law, as we all know, was tolerating two forms of bondage. It was tolerating slavery, and remember, before 1775, at least 300,000 slaves had been brought to the United States, what would become the United States, and also before 1775, half of the non-slave population were indentured servants, placed in indentured servitude. But nonetheless, unions were regarded as, in some respect, a criminal conspiracy. Now, nonetheless, employees were attempting to fight for their rights and join together. There's a record of New York City cart drivers in 1677 striking, and they were fired. In 1746, there's a record of carpenters in Savannah striking. And what happened? They were prosecuted as criminals. In 1806, shoemakers in Philadelphia were prosecuted and found guilty of a conspiracy for uniting together to raise their wages. It was illegal to engage in any kind of combination to raise wages. Why? Because this was looked upon as an imposition on the right of property of an employer to offer whatever they felt like. Well, in 1834, finally, you had the first union established in the United States, the so-called National Trades Union. And what was it set up for? It was fighting for a 10-hour work day. We all know about May Day. We know about the Haymarket riot that took place in the late 1880s. It revolved around a fight for the 8-hour day. Well, guess what? Is there any restriction on how many hours a person can work in the United States? Is there?
No.
No, there is not. There is not. There still is not. And then people in the United States are working longer hours than in any other industrialized nation. Now, finally, there were some glimmers of a change in the balance and the beginnings of a recognition that this restriction of freedom to property rights was an impoverishment of freedom. And in 1842, the Massachusetts Supreme Court acknowledged that food makers were doing something lawful when they went on strike. And you had the beginnings of a labor movement that was successfully beginning to organize large masses of people. The Knights of Labor were set up in 1869. In 1886, Samuel Gompers and others set up the American Federation of Labor. And I might point out one thing. You know, when I went to the public schools in New York State, and I had in my high school, which is a suburban public high school, I had a class devoted to the history of the labor movement. Now, in a way, something like that should be part of our public education. And if you want to be informed about the character of justice, the character of our society, and what rights you have, you should have as part of your study of history, the history of labor.
Also,
I certainly know for a fact that my three children who went to the public schools here in Athens, Georgia, never studied anything about labor. Never.
Right. I didn't either. And just if a school is meant to prepare you for a labor market, if that is so the case, which it is, I mean, I think most people would argue that, why is it not also that they would learn what their rights as a laborer are?
Exactly. And unfortunately, the rights that we have as employees are, needless to say, enshrined in the labor laws of this country and in court decisions. And these have been very, very limited compared to other countries. Despite the fact that the labor movement was beginning to build and large numbers of employees in what was becoming the greatest industrial power the world had ever seen, which was already gaining speed and traction in the second half of the 19th century, you had a kind of legal counterattack. In 1890, you had the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was intended really as a reaction to protect the market and consumers and everyone else from monopolies who were restricting trade. And of course, we had all these robber barons who were becoming huge monopolists, and they were able to restrict trade in a way that was to the disadvantage of consumers and employees and everyone else. But what happened after 1890 was that the courts began applying the Sherman Antitrust Act to unions and to say that unions were engaged in monopoly activity. Because what were they doing? They were sort of monopolizing labor power and not allowing individual employees to enter into an agreement with an employer, but instead having all of the employees be, shall we say, monopolized by this labor union to which they belonged and thereby be in a stronger position to bargain. Well, this was used as a way of attacking and once again criminalizing the activities of unions. And then there was another important case, the Lochner versus New York case in 1905. And it, in a sense, declared unconstitutional a law that had been set up by the New York legislature, which was limiting the work week of bakers to 60 hours, a 60-hour week. Well, this was repudiated as being something that violated freedom of contract. That is, freedom of contract is something in which property owners enter into a relationship to transfer property. Employees give up their labor power in exchange for some amount of remuneration. But any kind of restrictions on what could be the terms of that contract were regarded by the Lochner decision as a violation of property rights. Well, you can see that this again involved a tremendous blow to any possibility of asserting any balance in the interest between labor on the one hand and capital or employers on the other. Now, what began to change the situation to some degree in behalf of labor was the 1914 Clayton Act. And what that did was remove labor from falling under the shackles of antitrust law. The 1914 Clayton Act basically guaranteed to all people the right to organize and to strike. And it basically said that, you know, collective action by workers was not something that could be governed by antitrust law. And the reason is that laborers are not a commodity. They're not an article of commerce. They have a right to assert their interests just as much as employers do. Now, the next step in acknowledging and enforcing some rights on the part of labor was something that had to wait for the New Deal. And that was the 1935 National Labor Relations Act, which was set up under Roosevelt. And what it attempted to do was very specifically and directly correct the inequality of bargaining power between employees and employer. I mean, this is a watershed moment, but it also involved very important limitations that we have to take note of if we're to understand the situation we're in today. Now, what the NLRA Act did was it created the rights of most employees, not all employees, but most, as we'll see. It created the right of most employees to organize without being hobbled by what were identified as unfair labor practices. And the Act specified unfair labor practices that employers were not allowed to engage in to in some respect, hamper the ability of employees to unionize. What the Act also did is it set up a framework with regarding unionization. To begin with, it maintained that there could only be one bargaining representative for any unit of employees. Now, you don't have this in other countries in the world. For example, in France, you will often have multiple unions representing employees at the same workplace. And in the past, these unions used to be affiliated with different political parties. You had the CGT, which was affiliated with the Communist Party. You had the CDFT, which was affiliated with other parties, etc. And they often would be organizing employees at the same workplace. But here, the NLRA, National Labor Relations Act, maintained that it could only be one bargaining representative for each unit of employees. And what was also accorded to all employees was the right to strike. And also the right to engage in other activities to strengthen collective bargaining and to provide mutual aid and protection. This involved also engaging in collective action to support workers at other workplaces, at other enterprises. Now, what is very important about what the National Labor Relations Act did is that it excluded large numbers of employees from its protections. To begin with, it excluded state and federal employees. It excluded railway and airline staff. And it excluded domestic and agricultural workers. And some of these exclusions were even widened later. The 1979 Supreme Court ruling excluded the employees of parochial schools. And independent contractors were excluded, which today cover large numbers of people. Now at least 8 million people fall under that heading. So in a way, although the National Labor Relations Act provided protections and an opportunity for unionization and collective action to many employees, large numbers of our workforce were excluded from its protection. That includes me as a state employee. I'm not really protected by it. Now, there's another important thing that the NLRB and the NLRA did, and what it had in effect enforced by the National Labor Relations Board, which it set up in order to enforce its policies. It had certain policies regarding what would be the bargaining unit that could be unionized. Initially, the NLRB favored what goes by the name of industrial organization, which is what the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organization, was using in its big upsurge of organizing the auto plants in the 1930s. This is the idea that you want to have everyone at an enterprise organized under the same union. You had an alternate approach, which went back to the AFL, which involved craft unionization, where you have a workplace, people are doing different kinds of work. There are the electricians, the plumbers, the pipe fitters, and so forth and so on. Each would be represented by a separate union. Now that, of course, divided the workers and to some degree made it more difficult for them to stand up against the employer. The NLRB began by favoring so-called industrial or enterprise organization. Later on, it also accepted the craft trade representation model. But one thing it never did, it never accepted the idea of what is called sectorial bargaining. And that is something that has been used in many countries in Europe in recent times, where all the employees in a major sector of industry will engage in bargaining with all of the different employers, so that you'll have common bargaining with everyone in the auto industry, common bargaining with everyone in the mining industry, common bargaining with everyone in the steel industry, common bargaining with everyone in the pharmaceutical industry. And that, to some degree, allows unions to gather a kind of magnitude that they can't have if they end up being restricted to bargaining with a single kind of enterprise. Now, stop here for a moment. Yeah.
Right. Just for a benefit of that, there seems like you're talking about a magnitude. It allows them to amass the common problems and maybe rub out some of the kinks of the special interest groups, which is sort of a piece of language that gets used in politics quite a bit. And it's funny how it can kind of go both ways. For example, I mean, because I'm more adept with recent history, when I think about the struggle of employer versus employee rights, one of the main things that comes to mind is the Citizens United versus the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, because while that Supreme Court decision allowed money to equal free speech, essentially, under law, meaning that a corporation could then swing their stack around to benefit them in political campaigns and pay off who they wanted to pay off. It also supposedly allowed labor unions to do that as well. And that's a piece of the legislation that, or not legislation, a piece of the decision that sort of gets overlooked when we talk about this. In some ways, it could be a liberating decision, but most of the time, the employer is the one that is able to put their special interests ahead of the labor union's special interests. So this strategy that you're talking about sounds like a way maybe to bypass some of the issues of scale and issues of magnitude, as in if I'm a general podcast worker, or if I'm a general audio mixer, engineer, or if I'm doing freelance work for any type of industry, you could essentially band together with the people who are facing similar problems in those industry, and you would be able to have a general strike or work together collectively, and it might do better in those struggles of scale, of magnitude, than these sort of smaller special interest problems, specific interest problems.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you look at what is provided to labor by the Clayton Act and by the National Labor Relations Act, it basically provides protections for being able to unionize and for engaging in good faith collective bargaining. The regulations of the NLRB basically provide the following route to unionization. If workers are going to attempt to unionize, basically they have to get 30% of the employees to sign a petition or an authorization card to request a union. And that gets submitted and verified by the National Labor Relations Board, which will then order a secret ballot election on whether this union will become the bargaining agency for the employees of that enterprise. There are two cases in which another alternate route operates, namely if 50% of the employees sign on for such an authorization of a union representing them. An election can be avoided if the employer voluntarily chooses to accept it. And then there are cases where the employer has engaged in unfair labor practices, making a fair election unlikely. In those cases, if 50% of the employees sign cards to become union members, then the union is accepted. And the NLRB is in a position to require the employer to engage in bargaining. But on the one hand, these procedures have not prevented union membership to always have remained a minority, and now a tiny minority of employees. But they've also left open what it is that are going to be the terms of whatever agreement is arrived at. And it's not as if labor laws cannot deal with those issues. And you had some of that happening in the 1935 Social Security Act, which again was one of the big, big achievements of the New Deal, which basically set up Social Security as we know it, which in other words established a right to a pension and unemployment insurance. Now note, this was specified by law and administered by a large government agency. It was not something that was there because unions had, let's say, engaged in collective bargaining to get this written into their contracts. No, this is something that government had initiated and that was there and to be provided to all employees. Something similar was involved in the 1938 Fair Labor Standard Acts, which created something that was not arrived at by collective bargaining and could not be arrived at by collective bargaining. That is a national minimum wage. This 1938 Fair Labor Standards Act created the right to a minimum wage. And it allowed states to set higher minimums if they so choose. Unfortunately, like the 1935 National Labor Relations Act, there were many, many types of employees who were not covered by this. And this was also true of another thing that was part of this act, which is that you would get overtime pay, 1.5 times your normal pay, if you worked over 40 hours a week. Now, note, this did not involve imposing a limit of the week of work being 40 hours. It set no limits on the working week. But it said, well, if you worked more than 40 hours, you were to be paid 1.5 times. But there were 30 categories of employees who were exempted from this. Now, subsequent to this, there, of course, have been both executive orders and parts of our civil rights bill that have barred discrimination on the basis of race, creed, color, or national origin in industry and employment. And there have been acts such as OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which requires various standards of safety at work. And there was the 1974 ERISA Act, the Employee Retirement Income and Security Act, which did not guarantee a pension connected to the workplace, but it did guarantee that if there were a pension, certain standards had to be met. So we've had a certain amount of laws that have been appended to the 1935 acts, which gave workers the right to unionize and strike. You had the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. You had the 1993 Family and Medical Leave Act, which guaranteed 12 weeks of unpaid leave when you have a child. We still do not have any national requirement that there be paid leave of any sort. But as we've seen, all of these laws have limitations on to whom they apply. And there has also been a recognition that the procedures in the National Labor Relations Act have made it difficult for workers to organize. I mean, employers have all sorts of opportunities to try to influence employees and make it difficult for them to sign on a sufficient number of cards to move towards a union election. So there have been attempts to introduce legislation. There's the so-called Employee Free Choice Act, which would have allowed unionization to proceed simply by signing cards without need of any kind of ballot. If a majority of workers sign cards, that would be automatic. And you've had an attempt in last year to introduce a law called H.R. 2474 called Protecting the Right to Organize Act, which adds certain strengthening amendments to the 1935 National Relations Labor Act, revising the definitions of who qualifies for it, not allowing everyone who is a supervisor to be exempted from labor law protections, and it expands what falls under the heading of unfair labor practices in various ways, and allows for class action litigation by employees and any person to bring civil action for harm caused by labor law violations. But despite all of this legislation, you know, we find ourselves in a country with markedly restricted employee rights. For example, there is no federal law against unjust discharge. You know, we basically are in a position where in the country at large, with the exception of Montana, you can be fired at will. Unless you happen to be at a workplace where you have a union that has a contract that sets up various grievance procedures. We don't have any federal laws banning sexual orientation and identity discrimination. We certainly don't have any rights to participate in the governance of enterprises. We don't have a prohibition of mandatory overtime, which exists in other nations. We don't have, as I pointed out, any rights to paid leave and paid vacations. We don't have any limits on the work week. And in this way, American workers are less free than their counterparts in any developed nation.
And it's definitely a stress for most people compiled with the actual financial difficulties, besides not being able to experience labor in the way that others experience labor. It's certainly the way other countries feel labor. It's if anything, an incentive to move, which is never good for an economy.
I mean, you have to give you a sense of how things are different elsewhere in the world. There is a 1982 International Labor Organization Termination of Employment Convention, and it requires all signatories to ensure that any employer has a valid reason for termination of an employee, which has to be based on capacity or conduct. And if there is termination, it has to be done with reasonable notice, fair procedure, and severance pay if the termination is due to economic reasons. Well, this is completely different from the situation in America, where we are subject to the tyranny of being fired at will. And of course, who is it who loves to fire people more than anyone else?
Trump.
Exactly. Our Trump, who made a TV career, right, of firing people on his TV show, in effect.
Right.
Now, there is one modification of this firing at will, which is the 1988 Worker Adjustment and Retraining Notification Act, which requires a business to give 60 days notice to its employees if it is going to be firing more than 100 of them, or where those are 33% of the employees, or if it's going to fire over 500 people. We're very different from other countries. Also, the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights says in Article 24 the following: everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. Well, there is no general federal or state law requiring paid annual leave. Now, there is a Title V of the U.S. Code, Article 6103, that mandates 10 paid holidays for government employees, but that's it. By comparison, the European Union mandates 4 weeks of paid leave, paid holiday, for all employees. But here, no paid holidays beyond those 10 days for federal employees. No rights to paid family leave or paid leave for childcare in the United States. No rights to pension of any sort beyond Social Security, which pays people at a poverty rate of on average $1,400 a month. And many people are not eligible for Social Security, as we well know. and that includes often many of the kind of work occupations that were predominantly filled by people of color, such as domestic work and farm work. Mm. Now, there's one other thing that is completely lacking in the United States, and that is worker co-determination. And I just want to point to this before we discuss remedies to our situation. Now, worker co-determinations mean that workers not only have the right to engage in collective bargaining, but they actually have seats, they have representatives on corporate boards, and actually play a role in governing the corporation. Today, in most corporations, you have a kind of illusory democracy, where shareholders allegedly vote on boards of directors, and the boards of directors, appoint the CEO, the chief executive officer of the company, and they make the decisions regarding outsourcing, regarding selling off assets, regarding automation, regarding whatever the company is going to be doing. In 1919, Massachusetts gave manufacturing employers the right to have representatives on corporate boards, but only if the corporate stockholders agreed. In 1919, Procter & Gamble appointed an employee representation to its corporate board. During World War I and its aftermath, the Wilson administration established a National War Labor Board to sort of govern the labor situation during the war and maintain war production. But it gave rights to elected work councils. And these continued to exist through the 1920s. And you had something similar happening on a much broader scale in Europe. In Germany, at the beginning of the Weimar Republic, after the monarchy was overthrown, you had a 1920 German Works Council Act, which set up a worker council in all enterprises with 50 or more employees, which had a certain role in making decisions regarding the governance of the enterprise. Now, all of these work councils were abolished by the Nazis when they came to power, and they abolished them in 1934. Interestingly enough, when the U.S. government was occupying a part of Germany after the war, we empowered German workers to organize democratically elected work councils, as they had done under the Weimar Republic. And this was subsequently adopted in German law. In 1951, you had co-determination extended to companies in the West German coal, steel, and mining sectors who had more than 1,000 employees. They were entitled to fill half the board seats with employee representatives. In 1955, this was extended to all government workers. And in 1976, there was a co-determination law that extended co-determination to all firms with more than 2,000 workers. Now, in the United States, we have today very little of that. In 1980, the United Auto Workers got some board administration representation at Chrysler as a result of a collective bargaining agreement, not through a law, but through some collective bargaining. In 1993, the U.S. Steelworkers did something similar in five corporations. But nothing more than that has happened. And I think we need to step back and consider what are the remedies we need to reverse the progressive disempowerment of American employees, who have, in a way, an unparalleled lack of power if you compare the situation of employees in the United States to those in any other industrialized nation. We have far fewer people who are unionized, and unions have much more restricted powers, and the laws accord to employees far fewer rights.
So given this, a lot of the people that aren't able to enjoy the rights, the ones who are affected the most by this are disproportionately those who will work in more poverty wages. For example, if you're a highly skilled worker, oftentimes you're going to be offered all these benefits because you're more competitive in the job market than some of these, quote, lower skilled workers. So when you talk about who actually makes the decisions and who makes the power in, or who has the power in the legislation, it's going to be typically disproportionately people who have more money and don't see these problems as readily as somebody who's working lower wages or even just a wage laborer instead of salary labor. So I think it's important to reappropriate the term of special interest, that the real special interests are the ones who are blind to these everyday working problems. And in fact, it's the job of reinforcing labor unions to try and prop up these quote special interest groups, to try and make sure that everybody can enjoy the same kind of comforts of living in a very modernized country like America.
I mean, if we want to achieve that, if we want to even the playing field between employer and employee and ensure that the interests of employees, who make up pretty close to 95% of all breadwinners in America, are respected, there really are three avenues of reform. One consists in enacting laws that are going to provide things that are going to allow employees to really have their interests satisfied and be able to exercise their social rights. And these are not things that should be left to be achieved by means of collective bargaining. These should be established by law. And then one has to allow employees to wield the full power of collective bargaining to both improve their situations in all respects. And that means we have to rethink how it is that unionization is to be achieved so that it is not something limited to 10% of our employees, but it should be something universal. And then we have to think about extending worker participation in enterprises. So I'd like us to look at each of these in succession. So first, let's think of an employee bill of rights. I put forward an employee bill of rights as part of my campaign for the United States Senate, and I'd like to sort of go over the features of this, you know, beginning with certain laws that really provide a framework in which employees and their interests are being properly served. To begin with, instead of having these phony Orwellian right-to-work laws that restrict unions, we really need to fulfill the true right to work with a public job guarantee. And this is something where we abolish unemployment by having government step in and offer a job, a full-time job, to anyone who's willing and able to take it on. And of course, but can't find a job in the private sector. And of course, this is something that would allow us to mobilize millions of employees as necessary to furnish goods and services that we need. Like, in our crisis situation, everyone needs broadband more than ever. We could use a federal job guarantee to do that. We can use a federal job guarantee to provide decent housing to everyone. We can provide a federal job guarantee to provide an army of contact tracers as needed, an army of people to man schools that might be operating on double or triple shift so that we can have proper social distancing, an army of employees to provide public transportation as needed, et cetera, and to bring the arts and sciences to the public at large. Just as was done under the New Deal. And of course, let's not forget the Green New Deal. You know, we can put people to work with a federal job guarantee to help make the transition as soon as possible to a 100% renewable energy. Now, this is something that establishes the tightest of all labor markets, because it establishes 100% employment. And that is a situation that makes labor empowered to fight successfully for better working conditions and higher wages. Because, you know, it's an empirical fact that the higher unemployment, the more difficult it is for labor unions or employees to maintain their wage levels, because employers can always rely upon this army, the reserve army of the unemployed. Well, here there would be a reserve army of the employed to contend with. I had a friend who died, unfortunately, recently, too young, but his name was Ron Blackwell. He had become eventually the chief economist at the AFL-CIO. And he always argued that the most important measure for labor was a federal job guarantee. Because really, only when you had full employment, only when the right to work was really guaranteed, Would unions really be in a position to wield their power? Only then would the fear of firing be nullified. Now, of course, when we talk about a federal job guarantee, what also is part of it is that it involves a new federal minimum wage, and it has to be one that has two features that our current minimum wage does not have. And that is, it has to, first of all, start at a level that allows individuals to have a decent living and be able to wield all their freedoms. And that requires starting at $20 an hour, not $15 an hour, which is a poverty wage and a recipe for homelessness. Even the local Fox News station in Atlanta recently came out with a report saying you need more than $19 an hour to be able to afford any dwelling today. Well, we not only have to start at $20 an hour, but we have to also have that adjusted, not only with inflation, but with rising national productivity gains, so that all boats rise. And this will provide a framework within which employees will be able to negotiate collectively for better wages and better work conditions and shorter hours. Now, in connection with abolishing poverty income through a fair minimum wage, we also have to do something else, which is to abolish poverty, disability, and retirement income. And we do that by ensuring that replacement income for all disabled and retired individuals who cannot work is equivalent to the fair minimum wage. Now, these three measures, federal job guarantee, fair minimum wage adjusted for productivity gains, and equivalent replacement income, really provide a framework for labor to be able to wield its muscle on the basis of a genuine kind of economic independence that we all deserve. But we have to also make unionization something that is recognized to be a right that should be fulfilled. That is, everyone in a workplace with multiple employees should have union representation. And that includes employees who are in the gig economy. That includes part-time workers. That includes all those workers who are identified as contract employees. All of them deserve to be able to wield their bargaining power collectively and be able to sort of nullify the great advantage that the concentration and consolidation of capital affords enterprises. So how do we do this? Well, we have to go beyond what is provided for by the National Labor Relations Act. And that is, we have to have automatic union elections in any such workplace. And when I say automatic, they're going to be just as automatic as our elections for Congress. I mean, we don't have to sign cards in order for there to be an election. We have the election. If you want to participate, you participate. If you don't want to participate, you don't participate. But we have the election. We elect our representatives. At every workplace, we should be electing representatives who will engage in collective bargaining to which employers are required to participate. And in that way, instead of there being 10% union representation in America, we can surpass Iceland's 90.4% total. And in that way, really begin to speak about evening the playing field. But we can't really even the playing field unless we break the tyranny of corporate boards, where currently the CEO, in collusion with the corporate board, the board of directors, can have super salaries that are 300 times the level of other employees in the company. They can dismember companies. They can close factories and transplant them abroad. They can sell off assets to increase the value of the stock portfolio of shareholders. That is not going to happen if employees have 50% of the seats on corporate boards. And we have to make that a reality with worker co-determination, as they have had in Europe. And that is going to change from within the dynamics of the governance of corporations and really even the playing field. It has to be 50%. So both labor and the employer have an equal say and have to come to a consensus. Now, in connection to this, we have to end termination at will. We can no longer allow for an employee to be arbitrarily dismissed. There has to be a cause, and it has to be done with documented grounds that can be contested by some kind of due process. Now, there's something else we have to do, and this is against a practice that is becoming more and more prevalent, particularly with the rise of the gig economy, and that is we have to prevent employers evading extending due rights to employees by having part-timers, having contract employees, having gig employees, and basically classifying workers under these headings so as to avoid any kind of labor law requirements. But what we have to do is to ensure that all employees, whether they be part-time, contract, gig economy, contract, that they receive the same wages and prorated benefits as full-time employees. And to ensure that all rights are upheld by employees, we have to prohibit any contracts that require disputes to be settled through binding arbitration. That's a way of curtailing the collective action of employees, and we can't allow it. And that also means we also have to prohibit all the non-compete clauses that are now proliferating in employment contracts. Whereas if you leave a firm for any reason, you're not allowed to work in that industry for a certain period of time. Well, we have to eliminate that. Now, also, there are two other things that we have to consider. That is the relation of employment to family and the relation of employment to politics. If we are really going to balance work and family, we have to prohibit mandatory overtime, which has been prohibited in every other developed nation. They recognize that it disrupts family life. It puts employee health and safety at risk. Because if you have to work under mandatory overtime, how can you spend time with your family? How can you avoid the higher incidences of accidents on the job and the attack on your health that long hours presents? Then finally, we also have to have paid leave, paid emergency leave, paid sick leave, 9-month paid parental leave when a child is born, and 1-month paid vacations. And that way, we finally catch up with all the other nations of the developed world, which have ensured that as a condition of entering into a contract between employer and employee, employees are going to have these rights so that their family life is not going to be disrupted by the way they earn a living. Now, finally, another important right that we have to mandate is the right of employees to run for office. Theoretically, we have that right, but in reality, we do not. Because if you're running for an office, as I am, I'm an employee, I'm on unpaid leave to run for the U.S. Senate. In a race like this, you have to take off from work. If you're an employee, you have 3 strikes against you. You have no income for the duration of the campaign. You don't get any of the benefits, or you have to pay for all of them without the employer contributing. And you can't expect to have a job waiting for you when you return. Well, we have to mandate a law that is going to give employees the right to run for office. And that would be a law that requires employers to let employees go on leave for the duration of the campaign and to offer them their job back when the election is offered. And in addition, when employees go on unpaid leave, we have to provide replacement income equal to a fair minimum wage during their campaign. If we do that, then employees can exercise their political freedom, which today is not really possible. Well, taken together, these comprise an employee bill of rights that would transform the relationship between employee and employer in America. No interests would be overridden. Rather, we would be setting up a relationship between employer and employee that is fair to all, that benefits the prosperity of the nation, and that allows everyone to exercise their freedom in a nation where the blockages of opportunity have largely been overturned once and for all.